At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Art Slice is a different dive into art history. We goof around, we curse, you learn from it, but don't expect a typical lecture. You're welcome. Picking up a paintbrush while bedridden due to a sudden debilitating illness and inspired by the full culture and struggle of her country, this artist began creating eclectic, politically and emotionally loaded imagery without any formal training. You might be thinking Frida Kahlo, and the parallels are certainly there. But this is Violeta Parra. Neither artist was classically trained. Both drew from their personal experience with the folk arts of their country, Mexico in Frida's case, and Chile in Violeta's. Both Kahlo and Parra lived during a time when their respective countries were at a crossroads. Mm. Both women made it their mission to capture the full culture of their countries. Frida with a brush, and Violeta through song, poem, painting, and arpilleras, and both achieved international fame.
Running in circles with artists and authors such as Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Alejandro Jodorowsky, making uniquely abstracted marks that she thought of as songs, like a little bit like Wassily Kandinsky.
Wassily.
She would inspire artists nationally like Cecilia Vicuña and Victor Jara. And slowly, generations internationally.
Welcome to Art Slice, and an artist who, yes, should be as well known as Frida Kahlo is today. Violeta Parra is best known for her contributions to Chilean music here in the global north. However, like Frida, her legacy in Chile is one of a multifaceted artist who paints and weaves deeply felt emotions from personal experiences. Violeta performed in immersive sets and wore one-of-a-kind handmade clothing that spoke to her roots. I'm Stephanie Duenas.
I'm Russell Shoemaker is me.
And a little later on, we will be joined by the author of Thanks to Life, a new biography on Violeta Parra, Erica Verba.
In Violeta's far too short life, she and her children preserved over 3,000 Chilean folk songs, songs that otherwise might have been lost in the passage of time, given their oral tradition. And she continued to perform her own music inspired by those same folkloric traditions, evolving into what would become known as the New Song Movement.
Nueva Canción.
Carried on by musicians like Victor Jara. And she was also one of many artists who helped the rise of their own kind of like Chilean Bernie Sanders, but way more hardcore, meeting like somewhere in between, like mixing with Karl Marx, you know, in a little stew. Salvador Allende, a liberation populist that the U.S. would allegedly use their soft power to hard power, boom, violently cut short during the Cold War, giving way to thousands of Chilean deaths. Beautiful, wonderful things we do here in our big, beautiful America.
And as you all know, we love ourselves overlooked, underappreciated artists, and often that is art that is not the quickest to digest. Mm.
Deserves some a little bit slow looking.
It's fibbers,
like a slow cooker. Put it in there a while.
Fibbers.
So yeah, set the temperature to 8 hours. Temperature? Set the time to 8 hours. Fibrous art, like you said. Sorry.
Right.
Stepped on.
Yes. Fibrous.
Yeah.
So we had no idea who she was, but when we were invited to speak about her, I found so many connections to her, like Mon Laferte's cover of La Carta.
And Deerhoof's amazing cover of Gracias a la Vida on one of my all-time favorite albums, Mountain Moves.
But we were especially blown away by her visual work.
It's beautiful.
Yes. In particular, her stunning arpilleras, a passed-on folk tradition itself, were just as aligned with Violeta's interest in folk music, but would play a much larger role after she passed away, giving voice to those oppressed by the brutal Pinochet regime. More on that in a moment. Violeta didn't separate her art and music. To her, quote, "Mi música y mis pinturas son lo mismo. Yo canto lo que veo y pinto lo que canto." Or, "My music and my paintings are the same. I sing what I see and I paint what I sing. Every song was a canvas to be painted."
Her visual works were full of stories, right? Hopeful and spiritual, like her tree of life sprouting with the bird's song, her lineage and creativity taking root and expanding towards the endless sky.
Or sometimes they captured sadness, darkness, expressing her own struggles with death and mental illness. In particular, her paintings hit harder as they feel more intuitive through the colors and compositions. Quote, "Para mí, la pintura es el lado triste y oscuro de la vida. En ella intento expresar lo más profundo del ser humano. For me, painting is the sad and dark side of life. In it, I try to express the deepest part of being human."
Her painting's intuitive mark-making and emotive planes of color reminded us of Richard Diebenkorn's like landscapes and Florian Stettheimer's carnival-like interiors, suspending us in these dreamlike psychological spaces that are so immersive.
In Violeta's arpilleras, stitches can represent time spent making the work. Like her music, her art could be personal, didactic, or both.
A great example of this are her atonal anti-cuecas, the polar opposite of Chilean cuecas, dissonant rather than dancey, rebellious and revolutionary rather than like a rom-com sort of romance. In La Huelga de los Campesinos, I don't want to hear about my white-ass accent, okay? I try my best. Or the peasant strike, right? Violeta gives life to each individual striker, much like how Diego Rivera took time to illustrate each person uniquely in his murals, showing that the revolution isn't just this mass of like faceless NPCs, it's individuals with individual hopes, dreams, and passions. Holding deep personal meaning behind every detail, Violeta brought their unique soul to life, threaded through brown burlap in patterns and arrays of color.
Like Violeta's folk-inspired songs, these arpilleras did not appear out of thin air. They're rooted in folk history, which had been evolving for decades and decades and decades and decades. Violeta put her own unique spin on them in eclectic embroidery and patchwork color, usually from whatever scraps she had to work with. So, for more context, let's dig into a bit of Chilean history.
The longest country on Earth in the southern cone of South America, thousands of miles away from the Western Hemisphere where Eurocentric media dictates culture, and claiming many islands, including the Easter Islands.
All right, with the giant heads.
With the what now?
Deserts and over 1 million miles of Arctic territory.
And of course, colonization plays a big role in Chile's history. The Mapuche, who were and still are the largest indigenous group in Chile, were never completely under the rule of the Inca, one of the great pre-Columbian empires. And being as fierce as they were, not even the Spanish conquistadors, who arrived in the 1530s, were able to conquer them. It would take another three centuries, a Chilean independence uprising, and modernization before many Mapuche would be forcibly assimilated into the mestizo, mixed European and indigenous, Chilean population. However, this drastic change of life, for all of its modern innovations, was not evenly distributed. The larger cities became centers of modernization, while rural areas, when not being mined for their rare earth minerals, were left to crumble. Those were the areas where the population was often of Mapuche descent, among other smaller indigenous groups. Without the means to preserve their arts, music, and culture, it too was at risk of being lost forever. Violeta grew up in a town like this, and it drove her work, pointing to their struggles with both song and visual art.
As we alluded to, Chile itself went through many struggles. The poor would try and try and try again to rise up and back socialist-minded reforms, only to be beaten down. There was the Depression, there was the Cold War, all outside forces that the working class would bear the brunt of.
Violeta, while extremely successful artistically, even being the first Latin American artist to show in the Louvre, took her own life at the age of 49 in 1967, struggling with what is suspected to have been bipolar disorder. While her death was premature, her legacy has been long-lasting, especially with Nueva Canción, influencing the way the tides were turning for Chile.
After years of political instability, Chile saw that glimmer of hope with the election of Allende, the first democratically elected leftist leader in Latin America, and was heading towards a bright progressive future. which was a big deal because the U.S. had a long-running campaign to snuff out any and all leftist progression in Latin America, point in case Guatemala and Cuba. Unfortunately, that democratic victory wouldn't last long. On September 11th, 1973, that allegedly U.S.-backed military coup violently ousted Allende and placed dictator Pinochet in power. And his own version of Doge, the Chicago Boys, enacting 17 years of economic terror, while Pinochet's military enacted physical terror. Electricity and water was cut off to spread fear, hunger, and disorganization. Thousands of Chileans, many of them being leftist artists and musicians, including those heavily influenced by Violeta, like Victor Jara, were rounded up into the National Stadium where they were tortured and killed. Throughout the regime, many women lost their primary breadwinners when their fathers, brothers, or sons were disappeared, further encasing them in poverty. As we've seen with many artists that we've covered, the fight for freedom is synonymous with the expression of art. It's such a powerful tool, and whether it's 1970s Chile or the current day tech nightmare that we're dealing with, fascism acts to control your body while devaluing your mind and soul. One of the many reasons we've seen a push for AI art and music is to take away something that is fundamentally human.
And this is where Violeta, like her preservation of folk songs, also, maybe unknowingly, contributed to the continued lineage of arpilleras, a seemingly benign craft that suddenly took on a much deeper meaning. Women joined Women joined sewing sessions. Women joined sewing circles in secret to bond over their shared grief or mourning, often illustrating everyday scenes of lost loved ones, struggles, and mutual aid in embroidery, applique, crochet, and fabric scraps, often from the disappeared's clothing. It doubled as a form of income for the women, but also as a unified protest against the violence of Pinochet. Once the regime caught wind of them, they censored them and forbade their display. But being made of fabric, they could be rolled up and hidden during crackdowns. They were easy to smuggle abroad, alerting the outside to what was going on inside Chile.
Eventually, the dictatorship came to an end in the 1990s, and since then, those arpilleras have made their way to museums across the world.
Violeta's visual work, too, slowly gained admirers worldwide, finding her, along with other overlooked artists we love, such as Leonora Carrington, in the 2022 Venice Biennale exhibition titled Milk of Dreams. So, let's get into our conversation with Erica Verba. But first, speaking of dreamy liquids, Magic Mind has been helping our art slice flow the past few weeks. It really helps us focus so that we can make our dreams come true. And we mentioned them in our last episode. It's a mixture of top quality matcha, nootropics, and amino acids like L-theanine, or supplements like lion's mane and ashwagandha.
And my personal favorite, rhodiola, which I have been taking just on its own. But when it's in this combo, it just makes your brain like mellow out and focus up. Helps me, like I said, kind of wrangle my harder to wrangle neurodivergent traits, kind of like, you know, settles that steer, bull, cow. What do they wrangle? They wrangle something. It helps everything just kind of simmer. It's also really great with a small cafecito in the morning, mm-hmm. a little bit of coffee.
Synergizes. Yes, synergy is good. Yes. And we're both generally skeptical people, but there is a ton of research behind this. And to get your Magic Mind, use the code ARTSLICE20 for 20 to 48% off. This helps us and you.
Importantly, helps you out.
Yes. And if you're watching, please remember to like and subscribe. And if you're listening, leave us a 5-star review and share the show.
Really, it really helps this little mom and pop show kind of peek its head above the algorithmic slop that you're just fed on a daily basis. So we would really appreciate it. Or if you're listening on like Spotify or Apple Podcasts or any of the other pod players, take a moment, give us a little 5-star review. If you don't like us,
go in open and just go in and have an experience in a different world.
Okay, let's get into our conversation with Erica Verba for real this time.
Get on.
Let's do it. We would like to give an art slice welcome to Erica Verba. director and professor of Latin American Studies at California State University, Los Angeles. And we're here to talk about Violeta Parra, who was a composer, singer-songwriter, folklorist, and visual artist. And she is also the subject of Erica's new book on her super prolific life, called Thanks to Life, Gracias a la Vida. And yeah, I don't know if you want to give us a little intro about your book before we get going.
Well, yes, just thank you so much for having me on this show. I'm very excited. Violeta Parra was such a multifaceted artist that I've been on shows about music, and now here I am on shows about art, also about politics. So it's really kind of fun to see all of the different spaces where she can be talked about, you know, and understood, and all the different ways. I really am enjoying it. And maybe I'll start with the title of my book, which is Thanks to Life, because that's her most famous song. And you did say the Spanish translation, the translation of the Spanish, which is Gracias a la Vida. And probably 200 people or more have recorded, or musical ensembles have recorded this song. I like to mention, Joan Baez, who now everyone knows about because of the movie, Bob Dylan movie. Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist, did an instrumental version of it during COVID, sort of music to soothe us. Kacey Musgrave, who's a country star, recorded it as well. And then pretty much every major Latin, Plácido Domingo. But also every major Latin American singer, from Mercedes Sosa, Isaac Delgado, who's a salsa star, Omara Portuondo from Buena Vista Social Club. I mean, Elis Regina in Brazil. It goes on. Milton Nassi. It goes on and on. you name a musician from Latin America, odds are they've recorded one of her songs. Yes. It felt like the right title also for this biography, which is really the first. Well, it's many things. It is the first biography of Violeta Parra in English. So it does try to do justice to her poetry. Violeta Parra wrote her autobiography in verse, of course, in traditional verse style called the décima, which is 10 lines. Also throughout Latin America, you'll find it. It's a way to tell stories. So a lot of corridos, the Mexican ballads, are all in décima. So when she was going to tell her story, she decided, of course, to do it in verse. So anyway, it was translated by two friends of mine who worked together and did a fantastic job. So there's even an attempt for English speakers to be able to grasp the beauty of the poetry, which is also in Spanish as well in the book. That's one of the purposes of the book. And the other purpose is, I'm a historian, so I do try to really situate Violeta Parra within the larger cultural movements she was part of, which I'm happy to talk to about as well. So all of that.
Yes, and we would love to dive in. But before we go any further, Violeta was from Chile, but most of us, including ourselves, have not been to Chile. And I'm sure that it's more than, you know, the Atacama Desert and Patagonia. So if you don't mind setting the scene a little bit, that would
absolutely be
very helpful.
So she was born between the Atacama Desert and Patagonia.
Okay.
Chile is a very, very long country. It's a it's a beautiful country, unbelievable, with so many different regions. It's also probably the most narrow country in the world. I mean, I think it's the longest country in the world, but in terms of how narrow it is, I think it's 300 miles widest at its widest part. The Atacama Desert that you mentioned, it's the driest region in the world. Patagonia, of course, is, you know, borders on the South Pole. So you can really imagine all of the shifts in between. And she's actually from a small town. Well, she's from a small town in southern Chile. And she spent most of her childhood in southern Chile. She's from, I would say, a humble family. Her father was a school teacher, but he got laid off. And her mother was a campesina, which means someone who worked the land, you know, with her family. Mm-hmm. And they have 10 kids. So Violeta Parra's childhood was, you know, in some ways, you know, it began kind of privileged because her father was a school teacher and he loved opera. And the gramophone comes to that town, and the gramophone is, you know, the wind-up record player.
Yeah.
So you don't need electricity. So they listen to arias in their house because their father's, you know, an educated man. So that's not a typical rural campesina background, right? You know, she has some of that in her life. And her mother is a campesina, so she goes and visits her family in the countryside, and they teach her these traditional songs. And life is, that's sort of her childhood. And I always say that that's where she got the elements of her future incredible creativity, right? Because there's both sort of the urban culture, the possibilities that are in a way endless because, you know, the most famous tenor in the world, Caruso, is in your house on a gramophone, right? And at the same time, you're learning these ballads that have been handed down over the centuries. So she had both. She was at that cusp-like moment in cultural history where you could be both, right? You didn't have just one or the other. And then also she was very poor. At one point, her father does die and there's 10 kids to feed and their mother is a seamstress and working all through the night. And that's when Violeta actually embarks on her career as a performer, because she and three of her other siblings, they start playing on the street for supper, for their supper, which is, you know, children that are poor all over the world, certainly in Chile, find ways to feed themselves, right? Mm-hmm. So their way was, where they had a guitar they borrowed from a friend, they had baskets and they would play for their supper. Sometimes they'd get some money, they'd bring it home. And then they started, you know, by age 13, she's touring this southern region of Chile in a family circus.
Oh my gosh.
Which in Spanish, the way they describe these circuses, the term for them in Chile is el circo pobre, the poor circus.
Okay. Okay.
And it really has a double meaning. It means it's poor, right? It's like going around these, you know, rural estates and, you know, playing for campesinos, for farm workers. And it also means probably it's also sort of a statement about the quality of their acts, because there's like seven or eight people in the circus, so they're all doing everything, right? It's a world famous, you know, contortionist who's really the same person who's about to dance the cueca. You know, it's just all of these. Everyone had to do everything. The term for it was in Spanish, todista. That's the term that one of the circus performers invented, and it means an everythingist.
Love
you
it.
You do everything. So they were poor in that sense too, I guess. And so really she started her musical career as a teenager, as a young, even before she was a teenager, at age 12, she was already singing for her supper, and then she was touring with these circuses. And at one point, her oldest brother, whose name is Nicanor Parra, who in his own right is a very famous poet from Latin America, he gets a grant to go to some fancy boarding school for talented boys. And he brings Violeta Parra to the capital, to Santiago, to go to a teaching school, because there's no fancy school for girls, talented girls. There's only one for boys. And teaching school was a perfectly decent and respectable career for a young woman. And it was really actually high school. Like, she'd only finished elementary school and she did one or two years of this teaching training school and hated it and dropped out and started singing in bars with her brothers and sisters again, which is really what she did until her mid-30s. And her mid-30s is when there's this incredible shift in her life, where she suddenly, not suddenly, but she definitively, let's not say suddenly, but she definitively changes the music that she performs and what interests her. And she starts looking at the ancient traditions and folklore of Chile. So the first sort of step in this trajectory that makes her a world-renowned artist is to value the oral traditions of her country that are not commercial, right?
Mm.
So they're authentic. She goes and she interviews elderly people, and none of it's for money, right? They remember the old songs. Some of them that you can tell they came from medieval Spain. There's a ballad of Charlemagne, who's a French emperor, right? Carlomagno in Spanish. You know, like these songs are ancient, and she pieces them together, and that's really the first step. And there's a reason behind the timing, mm-hmm. which is these songs are disappearing, literally. I mean, once you have radio, soon you're going to have television. In most parts, maybe in the United States and England, you already have television. You're going to get television in Chile in the 1950s, right? But once you get these other medium, people don't learn songs by passing them down.
Gotcha.
People learn songs by listening to a record. And so they're singing the same version, right? I mean, if you're going to learn a Bob Dylan song, you're going to learn it the way Bob Dylan sings it as much.
Yeah.
And then maybe change it a little bit. But, you know, because you can't interpret it like him, but it's his song and it exists. Whereas these other songs that she's collecting, they're songs that no one owns, right? They're folk songs.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know who wrote them. We know that they're old. We know that there's many versions of them. We know that they've traveled. That's really what she's doing. And the word folclorista in Spanish meant two things. They would both go out and learn the songs, collect them, right? That's what the term was. You collect the song. But she would also perform them, and she'd perform them in the cities, right? And she'd perform them in, an audience that comes in, and sometimes they pay, sometimes they don't, but they're sitting in chairs and they're listening, right? It's totally different, completely different setting than where these songs are actually, you know, came from and performed, which is at parties or at wakes or at weddings. You know, they're not at a formal concert where people are saying, this is our folklore, right? They're woven into the everyday life, right? That's what folk songs are. So she really is making them accessible to an urban audience, which is really what the folk revivalists are doing everywhere all over the world, right? She's not unique that way. One of the great gifts that she's given to Chile and to the world was she was a very passionate and obsessive woman. She collected over 3,000 songs, we think. And she, and not just songs, but folk sayings and, you know, medicinal cures. And she traveled the length of this country that is the longest country in the world. And she traveled to very remote villages. She learned how to ride a horse. She'd go by mule. She would do whatever you needed to do to get there.
Wow.
And she'd spend weeks in these, you know, basically, I don't know what the word, I mean, poor people's houses.
Mm-hmm.
Because the farther you went away from the city, the better chances you were of finding this music.
Wow. So how did she go from that, from traveling all over Chile, collecting folk songs, I'm sure seeing a lot of art and meeting new people, to making visual art?
I love that question. And, you know, as a biographer, that's what I'm trying to figure out, right? So I have an answer to that. So she's also very political. And, you know, at the time, pretty much everyone who was artistic, most people that were artistic in Chile were either members of the Communist Party or what they were called, which were fellow travelers, people that supported the Communist Party.
Okay.
And just to put this in context, the country itself is divided pretty much in between rich and poor, with a very tiny middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And the rich are very small, very few. They don't really socialize with everybody else. They're a class, you know, like, you know, very. And then the poor are everybody else. And she really identified, especially because she had gone through that poverty. And so she was on the side of the people. And here's a party that says we're on the side of the people, meaning el pueblo, you know, like poor people. And I think also it's fair to say that they didn't really know what was going on in the Soviet Union. You didn't have to be a communist. You just had to be sort of leftist. Mm-hmm. She gets invited along with 70 other artists and musicians to attend the World Festival of Youth and Students in Warsaw in 1955, which was a Soviet-led festival. And this is probably how most Latin American musicians make their way to Europe, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you fundraise and you all go together as a delegation and you meet up with other delegations from all over the world. And that's what she did. She was in Warsaw for 2 weeks for the festival and then she toured Czechoslovakia. And then, you know, in the Soviet bloc, there's no way to make a living as a musician, right?
Sure.
That's not really a thing. So she did what pretty much every musician who made their way to Europe from the World Festival did, which is she went to Paris. She's in Paris in the 1950s and she's in the Latin Quarter, the Quartier Latin, in the 1950s. And one of the artists and musicians that she plays with at one club basically says, there's nothing like Paris in the 1950s because they're finally recovering from World War II. And there's just what he describes as, you know, it's a French expression you can't even translate, a joie de vivre, a joy of living that you can't find anywhere else. He really feels like it's like there's nothing like that. He goes out for a cup of coffee and he's sitting in a cafe and there's Sartre with, you know, de Beauvoir, you know, sipping coffee in the same coffee shop. And it's just, you know, he called it the center of the world, you know. And so she's in the center of the world and she's playing at a club. And some of the other musicians that are playing at the club to make money, one is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who is, you know, playing music so that he can fund his novel writing. Another is Jesus Soto, who's a famous Venezuelan artist who's in a duo with Gabriel Garcia Marquez. So there's, you know, these are musicians who are also visual artists who are novelists more appropriately, these are visual artists who are making a living playing music, right?
Okay.
And then she's part of the whole soup and she stays for 2 years. And then on the boat back, which is this ocean liner from Paris to Chile, She starts on the guitar, but she starts composing these amazing pieces of music that are atonal, that are modern, that are many people consider some of the best compositions for guitar that have ever come out of Chile. And I encourage your listeners to go and listen to them. They're called Anticuecas.
Okay.
C-U-E-C-A is the traditional dance of Chile. And these are anticuecas because they draw from the cueca, but they're nothing like a cueca. So that shows you sort of her creativity. And also it is a homage, a tribute to her brother, whose first book that put him sort of on the international map, which was also published in the 50s, is called Antipoemas or Antipoems. And so she does these anticuecas. They're shocking. People don't really know what to do with them in Chile because they're so out of character. They think she's this folk singer, you know, who's all sweet. And she's doing this like modern music. Oh, by the way, she has no idea how to write music. She has never studied music. She's, you know, she's composing them, but she couldn't write them down if you paid her. I think Violeta Parra was one of those people who had no concept of what impossible meant. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, she starts doing visual arts. So she's doing atonal guitar instrumentals, right? She's writing songs that sound like the folk songs she's collected, so very much in the folk tradition. She's writing newer songs that are protest songs that don't fit into any, you know, one category. She's still going out and collecting songs. Now she's collecting songs among the indigenous people. And then she gets hepatitis. She's stuck in bed, and her doctor has said she can't play the guitar. I have no idea why. But so she decides that she's going to paint and embroider instead. She starts with painting, but since she can't get out of bed and she doesn't like the smell of turpentine, she switches to tapestries. And the tapestries are on burlap sacks. That's why they're called in Spanish arpilleras, which mean burlap, literally. So they're called burlaps. Or, as her daughter said, if she ran out of burlap sacks, then the sheets or the curtains, because this woman's very obsessive, so she wouldn't take anything.
She's scrappy.
And straps of yarn. So, you know, there's a famous Christ in a bikini. That's what she calls it, Christ in a bikini, because, you know, he's got his loincloth. And she ran out of blue yarn, so half of it's yellow. That's one of her tapestries. And so, and you know, you could say, is that an artistic decision or, you know, it's all together, right? She ran out of yellow. So it's combined. She's very much a practical artist in that she worked with what she had and she was always broke.
Extremely relatable too for artists who, like, sometimes when you're in the flow of like making something, it's totally normal to just like reach for, you know, to improvise in the moment. And that's great to just, you know, pull down your curtains and start embroidering them.
A huge element of her artwork is that the materials she works with are very accessible. At one point, she does these incredible bas reliefs with, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, with out of paper mache, right? Mm-hmm. Paper mache is basically free. And so she's that kind of artist. Oil paints. She does have some oil paintings also, but she just uses all sorts of mediums. She has masks made out of beans and broken mirrors and all sorts of things. Real hair.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I think that the inspiration was being, I mean, I think the inspiration probably was with the absolute freedom that people were giving themselves in Paris in the 1950s, which, you know, Chile was not necessarily in that kind of place at the time. And I think also Violeta Parra's absolute sort of inner core that just didn't, you know, if she saw something that someone else was doing, she'd say, I can do that too.
Yeah.
That was really the kind of person she was. So she did. Many people can say that. I don't know how many people can do that. So, yeah.
Is there any connection there with her mother, too? You mentioned her mother was a seamstress. Do you think she...
Oh, absolutely. No, she used to make... That's a beautiful connection. She used to make rag dolls. I mean, she knew how to sew because of her mom. And she makes that connection. She really does. And she was very performative. I mean, she really had... You know, so she, at one point, the second time she goes back to Europe, she asks her mother to make her a quilted dress, a skirt, sort of, it's actually a dress out of scraps of cloth. And it's for people to know that when she was young and poor, that's kind of how they were dressed. Mm-hmm. Even though that's not really true, it's very symbolic, but she goes across Europe wearing this patchwork dress because she wants them to know who she is and where she comes from. Mm-hmm. And that sort of symbolizes it for her because they were pretty much, you know, wearing patched clothing, but not an entire dress made out of patchwork, right?
Hello, listeners. Stephanie here, flying solo. Hope you are enjoying the episode
you are listening to.
Ouch.
I'm here, Stephanie. I hope you can't hear the horde of hockey children. I think most of them have cleared out. There were hockey children above me, hockey children below me, hockey children on the fire escape.
Russell is on a work trip, apparently surrounded by hockey children.
To be clear, I don't work for hockey children. They just also happen to be here.
Well, as a quick reminder, hockey children or not, something that has actually been helping us in our day-to-day that keeps our creative juices flowing is Magic Mind. We mentioned it before. It's full of good stuff like L-theanine, lion's mane, ashwagandha, matcha, and you can use the offer code ARTSLICE20 for 20 to 48% off. But also, listeners, we just got back from the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, nestled among the hilly forests of the Ozarks in Arkansas.
One of our favorite places to go. Favorite place to go. Great coffee, great nature, great art. Always. All those things.
Yes.
Always.
We were there to check out the Kaz exhibition, Family.
Yeah, I wasn't like very familiar with Kaz. Like I'd seen his Michelin Man influenced character Chum in various installations and on t-shirts and things like that. Mm-hmm. So really, I kind of like equated his work to products. And I don't mean that like negatively at all, but I really did not understand how emotive and complex his work was until spending the weekend there.
Yeah, the show touches on many themes: lighthearted, serious, and sentimental, life-size installations of his vinyl toys, and his take on the Simpsons family, incarceration, isolation, and family dynamics. So you'll see some of the sculptural work that he's most well known for, but also graphical work, collaborations, street art, fashion, and paintings.
Paintings are like low-key, they're like assassins, like little painting assassins.
Stealthy.
Like there's they are this intersection of modernist abstractions.
Sometimes winking to Renaissance painting.
And like old school hand-painted graphic design back in the day when they did not have Photoshop, you had to paint that shit by hand. Which is like some killer color combinations. Mm-hmm. My color senses were tingling.
I bet they
like
were.
Like a Spider-Man. Yeah. He was really color adept.
Yes.
Like really notices color. Has a real colorful cape. Spider-Man has a cape, right?
I don't know.
I think he had a little cowl there for like a second.
I don't know.
I think he had a little mini cape. I'm serious. I don't know. Maybe in the 90s he had a mini cape. I don't remember.
Speaking of capes, there is something for everyone.
It was like a cutoff shirt. That's right. It was like a mid-drift cutoff shirt, and that was the Scarlet Spider.
Memory. There is something for everyone. There is something for everyone at this show, even the kiddos, but you artist listeners should absolutely not miss it. It will be on exhibition until July 28th. And, of course, the permanent collection there as well is incredible.
A lot of our Art Slice faves there. Agnes Pelton, Dorothea Tanning, Yasuo Kuniyoshi. They've also obviously like inspired like us to do some episodes. So it is a really great collection
it
to
really
check
is.
Out.
And it's only about 2 to 3 hours from Kansas City, Dallas, and Tulsa.
Yeah.
So it's definitely
Whatever
worth the trip.
Else is in that orbit.
Make it last. It's up until July 28th.
Yep, so you got plenty of time to check it out.
Nothing else like it. They're doing some really cool stuff down there that literally nobody else is. Mm-hmm. So yeah, support them, support the community, cause family up until July 28th. Let us know if you go and send us your pics. And then, of course, we want to thank our amazing patrons. I know we are all really feeling that financial squeeze, so we truly thank you from the bottom of our little corazones for supporting us.
If you'd like to join our Patreon, it really helps us plan and budget for the episodes in the future. That's how we were able to like go to New Ulm for our Wanda Gog episode, right? Hot tip, don't join Patreon on the Apple app. They tack on additional fees, and those fees just go to Apple. We do not see them in our pockets. Apple sees them in their significantly larger pockets. You can get around that by joining on your browser. Just join directly from your browser. That should work out just fine. If you want to help us out, but you don't F with reoccurring subscriptions, I do not blame you. I do not blame you. Buying some merch nets us about as much as a $2 per month patron donates in a year. So get yourself a t-shirt. Maybe our new
wah, wah, wah.
Creature Feature t-shirt illustrated by Stephanie and I. Mostly Stephanie. Let's be real. She does most of the illustrating here.
Featuring Remedios Varo, Edward Munch, Hokusai, Margaret MacDonald McIntosh, and from this year's features, Harry Clark and Wanda Gog.
All in kind of a spooky haunted house sort of situation.
/or/. Also, we could use your algorithm help. Please like and subscribe on YouTube or leave a 5-star review on your favorite pod player of choice. Tell your sister, your brother, your mother, your grandmother, your nosy neighbor, or your dentist even. Lastly, but definitely not leastly, keep making work by hand. Not AI.
Make art by hand again. Red hat. It says it on the red hat.
The world needs artists to tell their stories, listeners, now more than ever.
That's the difference. I wanted you, the listeners to know to what heights she got. Because, I mean, in some ways she was more recognized in her lifetime as a visual. She reached a higher pinnacle as a visual artist in her lifetime than she ever did with music. She was kind of like the flavor of the month in France. Today it's going to be Chilean folklore. Next week it'll be, you know, Indian raga music. You know, like you know, what happens in 1964. And I love telling this story too because it says so much about her. She goes back to Europe and now she's been making tapestries. She was making tapestries for 5 years. So she's been a visual artist for all of 5 years. And she goes to France and she decides that she should have a solo show in the Museum of Modern Art in Paris. And that's probably because when she gets to Paris, some friends of hers are in a group show of Latin American art, and because she thinks very highly of herself. So I think that that's kind of where it comes from. And she convinces the Chilean ambassador to France to write a letter to the director of the Museum of Modern Art saying, this is Violeta Parra. She's Chilean and she would like to have a solo show in your museum. And the guy doesn't pick it up because he sees her and decides that she's folkloric, mm-hmm. right? She's not a modern artist inspired by folklore. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Chagall. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking of Picasso, yeah. right? She's instead, because she's a woman and because one of her primary medium is embroidery, she's clearly arts and crafts, right? Mm-hmm. She's not a modern artist. And right. you're going to show some of her work and people can decide for themselves. He sends her over to the Museum of Art of Decorative Arts, which mm-hmm. is where you would have more of that kind of stuff, where the individual artist isn't important. It's more the form, right? It's, you know, mm-hmm. like furniture, you know, that kind of thing. And she gets a solo show. And the solo show is in what I didn't say about the Museum of Decorative Arts in Paris is it's housed in a wing of the Louvre Museum, of the Louvre mm-hmm. Palace. So it's the Museum of Decorative Arts, and then it's the Louvre Museum. Mm-hmm. They're all in the okay. same palace. So as far as she's concerned, she's gotten a solo show in the Louvre Museum. And we only know about the letter to the Modern Museum, Museum of Modern Art, because it's in the archives of the Museum of Decorative Arts. She, wow. that whole idea just disappears from her narrative. Mm-hmm. And basically, Violeta Parra had a solo show in the Louvre, and that's all she'd ever wanted. You know, that's where it began and ends. And so in 1964, she becomes the first Latin American artist. Let me be clear, not Latin American woman artist, just Latin American artist to have a solo show in that museum. And wow. that's pretty phenomenal. And then she did show a few of her tapestries more recently. She passed away in 1967, but two of her tapestries were shown at the Venice Biennial mm-hmm. in 2022, which I think is really fitting. And if any of your listeners have connections to museums, this woman's art should be seen. And I really hope you try to bring it to wherever you are.
Absolutely.
It's really hard not to compare her to Frida Kahlo. They have so many similarities. I thought it was really interesting that they both learned how to paint while bedridden. That was really interesting to me. But also, they were both very political and they were both communists. Mm-hmm. And they both became like symbols of their own respective countries. Frida's political work gets overshadowed, right? The communist part kind of gets hushed down, but Violeta was very vocal. And we really appreciate how it manifests in her inner tapestries, the arpilleras. So yeah, we wanted to touch on a couple of those because we actually wanted your insight on some of these. They're super interesting.
Oh, yeah, no, I'd love to talk about her art. I mean, her actual art. Yes, I've talked about her life and sort of how she got to be where she was. Yes.
Okay. Well, and too, if I could jump into even the clothing, too, kind of reminds me of Frida kind of dressing in a certain
clothing.
Way to embody a particular type of person that is overlooked in society.
Huipiles, the traditional
yes,
clothing.
Yeah. Yes, huipiles. Yeah. And she would mix it with like Zapotecan jewelry. She would just... Yeah. She would dress up so that she would represent her country, right? Which mm-hmm. to her was that region. I think her mom was from that region. And so Violeta, I think you're trying to say in her own way.
Like a strength. Yeah.
A strength, yes.
A strength of a certain sect of people, I would say. Like, you know, lower class people who have to be strong to like live in troubling times, I guess.
I love the comparison. I've always, when people, because I've been working on this book for a long time. This is really my life's work. And I'm not embarrassed. Yeah. I mean, it's just been a passion project to me for years. And I always jokingly say that I want Violeta to be the next Frida Kahlo because I really do think she does. You know, Frida Kahlo, I can remember when no one knew who Frida Kahlo was or that they knew her because she was Diego Rivera's wife. Mm-hmm. And there was a moment when that just changed completely as it should have, right? Yeah. And as it did. And now she's really known and there's, you know, a literature about her. And there's also, you know, she's an iconic figure and you can buy the magnets for your fridge, which is fine too, right? And people visit her house. I mean, it's just, it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I think Madonna owns one. I don't know. But, you know, like, and the movie, you know, all of that.
From everybody.
We talk about that a lot.
Yeah, no, and it's fine. It's good. Yeah. It's because she was so... We wronged her as a society by not seeing her talent from the very beginning. I would say that's very parallel, Violeta Parra. I don't think she was given her dues in Chile or even in the world while she was alive. And I think it's we're barely becoming, you know, I think in Latin America, I do have to say, I think that people know what an amazing songwriter she is. Mm-hmm. But some people to this day are surprised to see what an amazing artist she is, a visual artist. And so, you know, I feel like there's a reason why these women were overlooked, and it has a lot to do with them being women. Mm-hmm. So it's really, for me, it's that's a huge thing that they have in common, I think. So, you know, I love that comparison because I would like as many people to know Violeta Parra as know Frida Kahlo. It's always tricky because let's face it, some people don't know who Frida Kahlo is.
That's true.
That's true.
You know, you don't want to say I want her to be as well-known as Frida Kahlo on one podcast where they have no idea who Frida Kahlo is, but on this one, I feel very safe. I think she's important. I think her work really warrants mm-hmm. it. I don't think mm-hmm. she would have been in the Biennial of Venice, you know, 50 years, how many years? 60 years after she died, sort of an unknown artist. The tapestries themselves spoke to the curators.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
you know, so there's no question about that. And I mean, she really was pretty phenomenal and very prolific. So I think those yes. things too. And yes, they were very conscious of how the world perceived them. And they've tried very hard to have a say in how that would be, mm-hmm. right? So that how they dressed, how they presented themselves to the world. You know, they both were very conscientious about that, very mm-hmm. intentional.
It's a lot to process. She has such a great legacy. And I was going to go back to the Biennale. I was really pleased to hear that she was included in that show. That's one that I wish we would have seen. Yeah. It's one of those like, oh, we missed that one. Maybe, maybe one day. But Leonora Carrington was also included in that show. And she's one of our favorites here on this podcast. So she's another one that was overlooked for quite some time. Mm-hmm. But recently she's getting her dues. And like I said, Violeta Parra was also in that show. So it's really promising to know that she's on her way. So we're really happy that you're here so that we can spread the message and share her work with our listeners.
Thank you. No, I'm excited about that.
Okay, so yeah, the first work we wanted to talk about was La Huelga de los Campesinos, the peasant strike. I don't even know where to start with this one. I don't know if you want to jump in.
No, I think like what immediately in all of her work calls out to me is the mark making that she does with the yarn. forgetting my materials here is really beautiful. Like they break apart into almost geometric abstractions, and then they sort of outline these characters who are striking, but also each character sort of emanates, for lack of a better term, like a soul to them. Like they each seem to have like their own personality, their own characteristics.
They're all very different.
Yeah, they're very, very different. And just like beautiful use of like the material itself, the way that the figures rise and then collapse, and then there's birds. You know, it's just like this overall just like gorgeous image. It's kind of hard to find her visual work on Google, it seems like, yeah. just because and other sources we've looked at, just because it's so overshadowed by her like photographs of her and her music. But a lot of the work I've seen from her is very similar to, I mean, it's all very different, but it's similar in a lot of respects in the way that each person here seems to have like their own, you know, their own characteristics, their own personality, like emanating from them, which I think is like really unique.
I've never heard her interviewed about this, but mm-hmm. I would tell you that I'm guessing that in her mind, she knows who exactly, because I've seen, you know, I've seen her talk about mm-hmm. in there's this one video where she's a documentary where she talks mm-hmm. about her art. It was made in Switzerland. It's the only documentary about her. It's a 20-minute documentary, and it's called Violette Brodeuse Chilienne, which means Chilean mm-hmm. embroidery. You can see it on YouTube, and it was made by Swiss television. Mm-hmm. And she talks about her pieces, and they might be abstract to us, but she knows exactly who the people are. So yeah. I'm guessing if she were to be interviewed about this particular tapestry, she would tell you that's my grandfather, because I know there's that her grandfather is in here. I'm guessing wow. he's the tall man with the green and the black. Mm-hmm. And then she probably would tell you these are other people too. And what I love about her also, because she does it in her songs, I'm quite sure that some of these people, although they're sort of androgynous, we can't tell. Mm-hmm. I'm quite sure some of them are women, because mm-hmm. she always sees women's labor. And, you know, agricultural work is done by both men and women. There's no question about it. So I'm sure that they're also sort of present in this picture. And probably even the colors would have some meaning in that sense.
Oh, wow.
You know?
Okay.
Because she had people that she represented with different colors, because she was very spiritual in that sense. Mm-hmm. I mean, she really sort of tried to depict the essence of the people she knew and loved.
Yeah.
Oh.
And so
like synesthesia.
Yeah.
I'm sort of extrapolating from a lot of things she said about other pieces of art. But everything for her was personal. There would be a story behind this that she could share with us.
It's almost like she collaged them in, like each, or I don't know why, and maybe it's because she's a musician. I'm seeing like every person has a particular song, and the song, I don't know, when she would think about the song, certain colors would come to mind, and then that's what ended up on the surface. So yeah, I don't know, that just kind of came to me right now. I really like that idea.
For sure. And then I think also, because she really, really, she saw her music and her art completely connected. In fact, she at one point, and she's in Argentina and she's broke, and she writes to a Chilean, you know, someone she knows who's in Chilean television, saying that she wants to do a series and it's going to be painted pictures. So she'll make the painting and then she'll have this painted songs. Sorry, painted songs, painted pictures. That's very redundant. Painted songs. And so she would paint, make the painting, and then she would sing the song that goes with the painting. All he needed to do was send her the money to produce it. And to make life easier, you know, for the materials, for the art materials, because she didn't have any money. And to make life easier, her daughter, Isabel, who was back in Chile, she could sing the songs. It would be the same. You know, so she was always trying to. She really did see a connection between her visual art and her music. For her, they were inseparable, which I think was also wonderful. So every time she had an art exhibit in Europe or anywhere where she'd have an art exhibit, it would always turn into a peña, a concert, like a folk scene sort of thing. For Independence Day, she'd put up this kind of rustic structure with eucalyptus tree leaf, and then she would sing and she would dance there, but she'd also show her art. So she would turn sort of these musical venues into art exhibits, and she'd turn art exhibits into concerts. And that's really what she did. She just didn't draw a line between her different media.
That's amazing.
So I think that's too. And also, I hope that your listeners, viewers, I guess, is what you are. I hope you have a sense of how large this tapestry is. These are really, really immense pieces of work. And there's that too. There's just, you know, giving credit to them, I think.
We looked at her museum in Chile, and some of them are quite large. It was very impressive. I'd love to see them in person.
I mean, so it's like they're life-size figures in art. You know, they're real. Okay, wow. They're like real people standing in front of you, telling you their story and their protest. They're standing up. You know, they're there. So there's that too.
I want to get more into maybe some of her symbology here. So we also really liked her tree of life, the Árbol de la Vida.
Yes.
We recently went to Mexico City and we went to the Folk Art Museum and we saw so many tree of life sculptures.
Yes.
And we were wondering what this one would have meant to Violeta, because I know that it's a very universal symbol. Mm-hmm. So we were just curious as to what it would have meant for her.
Well, I think that's, again, I'm extrapolating from other arts that I've seen and from, you know, sort of just trying to understand it. So the Tree of Life is a very ancient symbol. I would say that the Tree of Life itself is part of her visual vocabulary in a way that none of us could just, now it's part of yours and mine too, because we've seen it. You know what I'm trying to say? Mm-hmm. It's not, I don't think she could pinpoint where the idea came from her. It clearly wasn't just hers because it's too common a symbol sort of throughout the world and culture to say Violeta Parra invented a tree of life, but it meant something to her. And I would say that her sort of her discombobulated body, that's very typical of her. If you have a chance to see El Circo, and now that you know the circus, now that you know she was a circus artist, it's an amazing tapestry. It's kind of got that same thing where people are a little bit cut apart, right? Mm-hmm. So we can assume that the purple is her. Because she has said in the past that when she's portraying herself, her name is Violeta. So that means violet. Okay, and so if it's purple, it's her. And the sort of lying on her side, like she's sort of surrounding the Tree of Life, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. And she's also at the roots of the Tree of Life. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense too. She's at the roots of it. And it almost looks like her hair could be like the roots itself, right? That's one thing I think. And then the bird, this just tremendous symbolism of the bird song, right? Music. Okay. And also freedom, I would say, all of those things. So I would, that's what this particular Tree of Life speaks to me. She did do it she has other Tree of Life. She has one with a cat, you know, she finally was able, she was mostly nomadic all her life. She lived in many different places, but at one point she's able to buy land because the exotica big band leader of the 1950s from the U.S. called Les Baxter recorded one of her songs and did not give her credit for it. A very first world sort of way of treating Chilean musicians. And she took him to court. And with the money she got from Les Baxter, big band leader from the United States, Capitol Records, She bought a piece of property. Mm-hmm. And then she eventually, she had a song that was kind of a hit. So she was able to build kind of a prefab wooden house on it. And she's had a beautiful, beautiful orchard. And she planted, one of her most famous songs is called La Jardinera, The Gardener. But she was definitely a gardener. And she loved that. When she was not traveling, she grew things.
That's beautiful.
That's so apt for her.
Yeah.
And all of her different, artistic endeavors.
Yeah. I mean, you've already said it, but it's the overlap between like music and performance and visual art. It seems like it's all like interchangeable for her. It all cross-pollinates, which is like so good to see. We always recommend that artists, try out other mediums, try out other ways of working, like write, make some, like, even if you're not good with music, make some music, like try video work, things like that, because it all like feeds each other. It's all this like work that just feeds each other, along with just, taking account of like life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really like her. I mean, we've already talked about it, but this kind of ties it together. Just her attitude of nothing is impossible. I think you said that. Mm-hmm. Nothing is impossible for her, and she would go and get it. And that's awesome. And I think that's something that we can all kind of live by.
I think if we all could have a tinge of that, just the idea that if you want to do something that you can. I think it's very important for artists. I was a musician, and at one point I was a full-time musician, professional musician. At one point we had recorded our second album and our manager came to us and said, the music was good, but our stage presence sucked. Excuse me. She basically said, I can't help it. And, I could see that because we had been working on what it sounded like, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and so she made us take a theater workshop, which none of us, we were musicians. None of us had ever thought about this.
Yeah.
And one of the first questions she asked us, and it really made some of us cry, not me, but other people in the band, was, who gives you permission? Mm-hmm. To be an artist. And there's only one answer.
Yeah.
And I think mostly the people that did cry were women, because really women are not given permission. You're supposed to put everything in front of yourself, So I do think that we raise men to feel more like they can go out and explore and do what they want.
Yeah.
And I do think with women, you're supposed to first, you have to check and make sure everyone's okay. And then you get to go and do that. And usually nobody's okay. So you have to, take care of them. Yeah. So it's like, who gives you permission? I think it's hard for anyone to have that kind of courage, to be honest. It takes great courage to be artists. And sometimes the most artist people I know are usually people that don't seem to have any other choice. It's like they can't not give themselves permission, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
But I do think it is hard to give yourself permission, especially in this day and age. To just say, I am going to be a creative person and that's that. And I don't care if the rest of the world notices or not, because it really has to come from the inside. And as she was just, she just gave herself permission all the time. And a world that really did not give her permission. That's a large part of my biography, is how hard it was for her to be who she was.
You basically like answered a question I had for you later, which was, what do artists do in a time of instability and at a time when it's harder and harder to show your work? Like, I think like so many artists and musicians, like all sorts of creatives, we've kind of been taught over the last 10 years, like it has to be online and like it has to be seen. It can't just be for yourself. It can't just be you pulling down curtains off the wall and stitching into them. It has to be this beautiful thing that's like seen and appreciated by people, but it doesn't have to be. Like it can come out later. It can be for yourself. So
it can be bad at first.
Yeah,
that's
fine.
Well, and I think it's, it ties into a lot of our mental health issues in our society right now. I'm serious, because creativity is what saves us. Art, I think there's consensus. Anyone who's involved in the art world is completely in consensus. If you sing with your friends, you'll live longer. I mean, it's quite, or maybe you won't, but you're going to enjoy yourself more. You're going to feel connected. And if you take the time to I don't know what your medium are, but to draw or to paint or do whatever it is that you do, to express what can't be expressed in any other way, right? Mm-hmm. Art is how we express the unfathomable. And there really so much in our lives is unfathomable. So, and we have gone so far away from that. And this, I don't mean to be like, dystopian, but AI.
Yeah.
I mean, please.
Yeah.
I mean, supposedly AI can write music and also make art. I don't know. I'm more a musician. So it's like, and we'll never know if it's better or not, right? Because they won't care, because it'll be free. It's like, I have a friend whose job used to be to curate, box sets. And there was so much love and research put into it. And then it doesn't, we don't know whether the algorithm is as good as the box set. We just know that it's free. And so no one, there's no job of curating anymore, right? Because an algorithm will do it for us.
Yeah. We have strong feelings.
We rail about AI. Don't worry. We can talk about AI here.
Okay, good.
Absolutely. Just the fact that it's called artificial intelligence when it's just
the
like
red flags.
Like taking other people's work and remixing it is pretty sus. And the fact that that's what they chose to run with first is like, hey, know your place. Know that you should just be working and not creating work. It just really devalues like an essential part of our soul.
I think I read somewhere that for her show at the Louvre, she did not have enough money to make posters, and so she made it herself. Is this true?
I think you're thinking of the first time she ever painted in Chile. Okay. So I think you might have read it in my book. It was how she got into the visual arts.
Then
it was that she didn't. The woman said, why don't you paint them instead of, because we don't have money to print them. But this is absolutely, I think this is very Violeta Parra because it's her signature. It's her writing. It's her freedom. That really is like, that's how she wrote her name. And also, you know, the way that she has the sort of the ocho, the date kind of all running into each other.
Yeah.
And the eye, which one art historian, so I'm sure she's right because I'm not an art historian, but she said that this eye is very surrealist, which I could kind of see. And also, I think it's also funny. I mean, I think it's her way of saying, come see my show, right?
Yeah.
But without writing it out. So
cool.
She had a wonderful sense of humor. So I think that's kind of her invitation. Literally, like with the eye and these wonderful purple eyelashes, and you know, I just think she's saying, "Come see this, right?" That's for me. That's what the message is, and it's so playful, and it, you know, she was very careful to put Palais du Louvre in it, right?
Yes,
you know, it's like
all caps.
The museum is smaller. The name of the museum is fine, but it's in the Louvre, right? You know, let's be very, very clear.
Yeah.
So it's very celebratory, I think, also, and her name, and I love her for this. You know, the invitation that the museum sends out says Chilean tapestries in big. And you know that like the I'm you know again flavor of the month next week it would be Indonesian puppets, right? And then in small by Violeta Parra, because the name of the artist wasn't important, right? It was the exotic sort of foreign sort of medium that was important. And she's just the opposite. Like she's the opposite of the printed invitation that the museum sends out. She's Violeta Parra, bigger than anything else, right? And the eye, come see me. In the beginning of my book, I have a note to the reader where I say, don't read this book until you go and listen to her music and you go and look at her artwork, because this woman fought so hard, really hard, to be seen and heard that we might as well, we really should honor her request, right? You know, for me, it's more important. I don't care if people, I mean, I'd love it if you bought my, if you're interested in her, buy the book, read the biography. I think she's really got an interesting life story. She should be more known. But if all you do is go and listen to her music and see her art, I'm more than satisfied, because she deserves it. She really needs to, she deserves to be seen and heard.
I think you did an excellent job of not just telling her story, but also bringing in other perspectives and other like quotes from other people that were maybe met her once or twice, but it's a very important quote, a very important perspective that maybe we didn't have. I feel like I have such a great grasp on her life and her story. And it tied in a lot of things that I already kind of knew, like about Chile. Like I knew about Victor Jara. I didn't realize that he was so inspired by Violeta. Like I had no idea.
Yeah.
So it was wonderful to see all of those different pieces that come together in your book. And now we're talking about her art. So it's been a really lovely experience.
Well, thank you. That means so much to me because I'm an academic. But I did not want to write an academic book. So sounds to me like, it sounds like you enjoyed reading it.
I did. I guess. You have the decimas in there. Like it's almost an artwork in itself, but like literary, right? Because it, in its own way, it's kind of like, I want to say like one of her tapestries, you know? Each chapter is its own thing, but you're narrating and then it turns into the decima. It's just, it's in English and it's in Spanish. So for me, that was really cool. I'm bilingual. So it was really awesome to hear both translations, I guess. So it was a really rich experience for me as well in that sense.
Oh, that makes me so happy. Yeah. And the translators will be so, so happy as well. They really wanted it to be, they were very adamant that it wasn't going to be literal. A Chilean friend of ours who, he sings Georges Brassens, the French folk songs, and he translated them into Spanish. And so he gave us the advice that it should have a meter. That our poet, you know, it doesn't have to rhyme because that would be too much. It should be musical, as musical as her own poetry is, because her poetry is very musical. So that's, they did a fantastic job. Their names are, I want to give full credit, Nancy Morris and Patricia Vilches, and they just did a fantastic job. So that makes me happy. I thought of it as quilting.
Yes.
Because I had all of these pieces
and
writing the biography felt like I was quilting. It really did.
It's a great observation. I love it.
Yes, thank you. I was like, there's a word. I'm seeing, now that you say it, I'm like, I was seeing Violeta's dress, her dress in my head, but like I couldn't think. Erica's wonderful biography on Violeta Parra is called Thanks to Life, and it's available on her website, ericaverba.com, ericaverba.com. There you can find a playlist that follows along with the songs mentioned in the book. There's also tons of other resources like links to the Violeta Parra Museum, as well as the Violeta Parra Foundation. Don't forget to grab your magic mind to make your liquid dreams come true. Use ArtSlice 20 for 20 to 48% off. And
it's really good. It's really good. We say
no,
this.
Really,
we really, really like it.
It is. Yeah.
It's really helped us out. Definitely try it. Try it out. Try it out. Let us know what you think.
Yeah. And please, please, please remember to like and subscribe or leave us a 5-star written review. Pretty please.
Okay.
Pretty please.
Okay. We should be back very soon with either an episode on Mary Cassatt or perhaps? Perhaps.
Perhaps. Are you Ajax?
Or maybe Yasuo Kuniyoshi. It's kind of a race for which one gets finished first. And we got some very exciting episodes coming up very soon.
Yes, we do.
That you want to chime in and follow us on Instagram, even though we don't really like to post there anymore because we're going to be sending lots of updates and stuff about
newsletter.
Yeah. Oh, the newsletter.
We have a newsletter.
Subscribe to the newsletter.
Yes,
that is
free.
Much better.
We will not bother
that.
You.
Yeah, we don't bother you very much. Just updates like maybe once a month, sometimes twice a month. Mm-hmm. ArtSlicePod.com. Sign up for that. The newsletter, much better than Instagram.
Yes.
Actually, just stay off Instagram.
Fuck
if
Instagram.
You can, okay. But if you are on Instagram, please,
yes,
you
please
know,
like our stuff.
Please like our stuff. Because, yeah, like I said, algorithmic slop. We love you.
Yeah, we love you.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Ciao. Adios.
Yeah, get on.
Your kid could not have woven that. Bye.
Yeah. Bye.